It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us every Friday at this time. We rebroadcast David on the weekend and, of course, Monday following the 12 noon news. David, besides being on the air with us, has his own terrific website, themediabeat.us, and he is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And are you back in the good old U.S. of A there, David?
No, I am still reporting to you from overseas. I'm in the British Isles still, though part of the British Isles that is not British. I'm in the island of Ireland, back in Dublin, and I'll be here for a few more weeks. I'm using the opportunity to take a long overdue survey again for me of the British Isles, surveying all the constituent countries that make up the so-called United Kingdom in particular. So it's involved me since you and I last spoke. It has involved me crisscrossing several borders, or two borders, in fact, but in different directions at different times. So I've been looking at quite a wide area of interest, and can report back on it if you're interested. And I suspect you probably are.
Absolutely, because we've been talking about one of the major effects of Brexit is the border situation. So I guess that should be at the top of the list. And then we'll talk about how the economy really took a falter in 2020 for the EU and for the UK especially.
Sure. It's more than one border. That's the point. I took a journey that involved crossing the Irish border, obviously a historically greatly disputed border, but that's a national border between two sovereign states, the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland. The other border I crossed happened to be between England and Scotland, because I took a ferry across from Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, of course, still, but it has this peculiar status now of being somehow involved still in the European common market that makes up the European Union. It has a peculiar status in the post-Brexit era. But I crossed from there to Scotland, which is, you know, wholeheartedly, for now at least, part of the United Kingdom. But I then crossed another border into England, and crossing that, traversing Scotland before crossing the border, one of the great differences that I noticed is that while I've reported on Scottish separatism, Scottish nationalism, many times over in the last few decades, I think this is the first time when I've seen what's known as the Lowlands, the area closer to England. It's the first time when I've seen such visible evidence, basically the Scottish national flag, what's called the saltire, the diagonal cross of St. Andrews, white on blue, flying so much in that area. I was used to it in the hardcore Scottish nationalist areas further north, but this is the first time I saw it so clearly in evidence close to the border. So that's evidence, I think, of a change of heart in Scotland, and certainly public opinion polls are suggesting that the idea of Scotland separating off from England, now that Britain as a whole has left the European Union, is getting stronger and stronger. And as I say, public opinion polls are backing up that notion too. And one of the factors, I have to say, that happened in the last couple of weeks to emphasize that afresh was a visit by the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to Scotland, part of his effort to demonstrate that the union is still strong between England and Scotland, and that his government's work to roll out the vaccine, which is, generally speaking, not a bad piece of organization in the end, although it was Britain had a shaky start of coping with COVID. Its record on vaccine rollout is much better than many other countries, certainly many other countries in Europe. So partly to try and demonstrate how well that's going north of the border, the Prime Minister came north, and in the words of one rather cynical public opinion pollster said, this is one event that can guarantee an upsurge in Scottish nationalism, the visit by a British Prime Minister, this particular British Prime Minister especially. And that's exactly what happened when the opinion polls recorded people's reaction to his visit. A lot more Scottish nationalist sentiment spiked.
Now, you know, we've talked about this before, and it, in our world nowadays, how realistic is it? I mean, most Americans, I think, sit here and think that it's just talk. But Brexit was that way. How serious do you think this is, and do you think that this breakaway will happen?
That's a difficult thing to. Well, one thing I should say is that journalists should never predict. But of course, a lot of us do spend our time trying to predict. Just as, and I would say this, every journalist and every consumer of journalism should always, approach matters with a great deal of caution. Things are not always exactly as they seem, certainly not exactly as they were reported in the media. And consider the source. That's always a good principle that we adhere to in this slot, don't we? And also just pause and think, how likely is this apparent truth to be actually true? And Scottish sentiment is a sentiment for nationalism and separation from Europe is a tricky thing to assess. I must say that at the outset. But as I say, there are signs that it's stiffening, this opinion for a breakaway. Now, economically, it doesn't make the greatest of sense. There are ways of looking at the revenue and the expenditure ledger, if you like, of the two countries, and it suggests that Scotland benefits a lot more from being in the Union with the United Kingdom as a whole than it would separately. That wasn't the case during the high peak years of lots of Scottish income from North Sea oil when it was discovered and first came online. But now it's a more iffy prospect. So I think to make a broad generalization, this is more of a sentiment than a hard-headed sense of how Scotland could survive as a separate entity. But on the other hand, many political decisions are taken on the basis of sentiment rather than good economic sense, as I think many people in England would admit about Brexit.
Well, yeah, I mean, Britain is in a far, not a far weaker, but a weaker position with trading partners. And I was going to ask you, is Scotland really strong enough to go it alone? I mean, they do have revenue producing things, but wouldn't them going it alone open it up for more treaties that would have to be between England and Scotland? I mean, it appears that it would be almost like a tangled web.
Tangled web, it certainly would be, and having to refocus and re-establish trading arrangements across that border that I was perfectly at liberty to cross and recross without any. I mean, it's almost a non-existent border, and I know we say that often about the Irish border, but even more so about Scotland. It's totally seamless. Imagine that as a place in which you would have trading posts and checkpoints. It's very hard to envisage that, but the logic of separation would involve that in the end. Although, of course, in these days of electronic surveillance, you can do an awful lot of checking without having a physical checkpoint, at least not a substantial traditional physical checkpoint. And yes, indeed, it would involve a huge recasting of the economic relationship and a regular day-to-day business between the English and the Scots. It is very hard to envisage, but as I say, sentiment could often carry the day. One thing about Britain's position in Europe as a whole, which has been changing as an almost immediate result of Brexit, is that some very interesting problems have occurred in terms of delivery of goods between Britain and Europe now. And more importantly than that, perhaps, is on a broader canvas, trading in the financial industry. The finance industries has taken a really remarkable turn. Take this in as a piece of factual development that may come to many people as a great surprise. Amsterdam now, the Dutch city, the financial center there, is now, as of last week, trading more stocks and shares than the London Stock Exchange. And that's a remarkable change. I think people in the money business will, of course, go where their money makes greater sense and operates more successfully. And the London Stock Exchange, once preeminent in Europe for stock trading, is now taking second place to, of all places, Amsterdam. So things are definitely changing as a result of Britain leaving Europe. And if Scotland splits off as well, no one should be surprised. Although, as I say, it's very difficult to envisage all the detail being sorted out.
Now, I want to go back to COVID-19 for a second, but whether you're talking about it. I mean, here in the United States, we've seen a dramatic drop-off, finally, 25% in the death rate, in the admission rate to ICUs, in the hospital admissions. And basically, there's every state shows a decline now, except for just a couple of states with COVID-19. Of course, we are going into spring break here. More people are concerned about spring break than Easter here as a holiday. But Easter as a holiday, where you are things letting up there? Are the conditions letting up where Easter can be more of an open holiday, or is that still going to be confined over there?
The numbers are going down, that's undoubted. It's still very serious. It's being taken very seriously, too, as a disease. There's no getting away from that. But deaths are down, hospitalizations are down, test figures are down, testing positive numbers are down. But no one's relaxing here, I don't think. No one is imagining that the economy of either country, either Britain or here in Ireland where I am, that there's going to be any lightening up of restrictions anytime soon, at least. Of course, business and business people are urging the governments in both countries to lighten the restrictions as soon as they possibly can. But that pressure is, for the moment, being resisted. And I can't imagine anything like a loosening of the very tight restrictions in time for Easter here. That would be very unrealistic, I believe.
Now, one of the stories that I followed this morning when I woke up is once again involves Vladimir Putin and Russia, and how there's now a threat over to the EU that Russia just doesn't want the EU to get involved in what they, of course, are involved in with poisoning and with killing people like that. That broke this morning that he would consider just cutting them off and going it alone.
Sure. Russia is isolating itself ever more deeply. Its behavior in terms of its aggressiveness towards, its verbal aggressiveness, anyway, diplomatic aggressiveness towards the rest of the world is sharpening. And its internal behavior against dissidents is, of course, being demonstrated so clearly in the aftermath of their prime dissident returning after having been poisoned and recovering, and then willingly going back to find himself imprisoned again, and now on trial on two separate charges, one historic and one supposedly current, but looking to the outside world extremely thin in terms of anything that wouldn't be taken seriously in the outer world. But Vladimir Putin, yes, determined, I think, to tighten the screws on his own people and to say to the rest of the world, leave us alone, to carry on in our own way. It was only a matter of time before this would happen, I think. And in the end, it's going to be a struggle between Vladimir Putin and his own people. I think that what's pretty clear is that popular support for him, which once flowed very high, the tide was extraordinarily high in his favor, and now that can no longer be relied upon. And I don't think he's a man to panic. He's too cool an individual for that. Any KGB, former KGB colonel, is likely to be very measured in his response to what might be going on around him. But I think he's certainly got a bigger problem on his plate than he ever expected to have.
And do you think that this comes at a great time for the United States to regain maybe some of our world footing, to once again rejoin with our partners in the UA and the UK and stuff like that? Do you think that also plays into this?
Well, as far as the rest of the world's concerned, and I've been scanning the world's media about this, and your phrase there is very apt, America's footing. To the rest of the world, it does seem as if America has lost its footing. It's certainly lost its preeminence and its clear and clarion-like voice when it comes to matters like, how to react to autocracies like Russia and China. And at the moment, for instance, the smaller but still pernicious autocracies of the military autocracy of Myanmar. These are situations around the world where America once had a clear and loud voice. That got very foggy and unclear in the last 4 years. And I think, yes, the rest of the world is looking to America under its new administration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to get a little more clarity and a little more assertiveness in terms of taking on the wrongs of the world. Now, we mustn't feel morally complacent about that. I think America's got a track record which doesn't quite entitle it to lead the world necessarily automatically. But I think it's being looked to now by the rest of the world for a reassertion of confidence and clarity, especially in matters of ethical conduct, of rule, and of diplomacy. I suspect that we're going to get more and more clear messaging coming out of the White House, and that can only be welcomed by the rest of the world.
You know, it seems like it's almost a perfect storm for Joe Biden to come back and reassess not only domestic policy, but more importantly, make it an easier task for the United States to rejoin the rest of our allies by having things that we can join in, like what's happening in Myanmar, what's happening with Putin and stuff. It just seems that it gives the United States an access road to make the job of rejoining the world community easier. Do you view that from your post over there?
Sure, that's exactly what people are expecting, hoping for, of course, but realistically expecting as well. The Paris Agreement on climate change is a case in point. I think in many different ways, America has the chance now to rejoin the community of nations that it's sometimes rather over optimistic. Tamp down crises and solve them when they can be solved. Obviously, there are places in the world where that doesn't apply, and you know, continuing conflicts still deface the sight of the world as you look at it as a whole. Syria, for instance, is a tragedy still after all these years. But on the whole, the United Nations, perhaps, is the biggest example of separate countries trying to do their best to make the world work better. And America is showing now full signs, very encouraging signs, as far as much of the rest of the world is concerned, that they're going to rejoin that membership of all the international bodies that they need to be part of, not least the United Nations itself, of course, where we've played a really sort of pathetic, I would say, role in the last 4 years as any kind of stable and steady member of that international body.
It's so good to have you on the air, especially this time over there, because my final topic that I want to bring to you once again also came when I was coming in this morning and listening to the news, where China has banned the BBC World News from broadcasting in the country on both television and radio. And they've done that because they're really upset with the coverage of the coronavirus and persecution of ethnic minority. What do you think about that, and indeed
Hong Kong as well, yeah. Another irritant for the Chinese Communist Party. The fact that the BBC reports so thoroughly what's going on in Hong Kong. Well, yes, that again was only a matter of time before the BBC would get itself banned. I mean, it's not been trying to do that. It's just been doing its normal job. I should state something about my relationship with the BBC. Unlike many British journalists, I have not worked for the BBC. At least I've not worked for it very much. But on the other hand, I'm a huge admirer of the BBC. Not an uncritical admirer. I have my criticisms too. But it does a splendid job, I have to say, in covering the world. It is possibly the most preeminent international broadcasting organization in the world. And although many other countries would see it as some kind of arm of the British government, it is not. Its funding is somewhat complicated, and it does take some money from the British government for its international work. But you just have to look at its practices, its custom, and its history, and you'll see that it is, on the whole, behaved like a very, very independent voice of serious-minded and thoroughgoing journalism. And of course, if you're that kind of organization doing that kind of work, then of course, you're going to run into trouble with the Chinese Communist Party on all the issues that you just mentioned. And it's inevitable, I think. Where it's going to go from this point on, I would hesitate to predict, but it's clearly a standoff.
It's one of the things. We're now about 12 years old, and when Jill and I started Robin Hood Radio. We chose the BBC over the Associated Press. We chose it over American networks like NBC, ABC, CBS. And we chose it simply because BBC World News covered more than just one particular thing in one particular country. And also the fact that if you look at news bureaus across the world, The United States, basically, most of the networks have cut down their news bureaus drastically. Now, the BBC did something different. They cut down some of their radio stations in a lot of the far-flung places, but they kept the news bureaus and people on the ground. And we just think that the BBC gives a far better perspective on the world. And the world is now such a small place that we just think that their news is much more reflective of what people really want to hear.
It's hard to disagree, though I should point out that while you're right, American networks have been shutting down bureaus left, right, and center throughout the world. NPR, to its credit, has been opening up bureaus. So the NPR is not to be sneezed at. NPR is a powerful force, but of course, a powerful force journalistically, but for the American audiences. But of course, the BBC is so much bigger, and its global reach is so much more considerable. And I would say that its consistency is that much more established and demonstrated over the decades. I think you're basically right about the BBC, and I hope Robin Hood Radio continues to carry it, as well as this slot as well, of course.
Well, you know, and one final thing that before you go, we have to bring it up. Of course, the impeachment trial is underway. The Democrats have
Well, can I say how it's regarded here in Ireland?
Yes,
it's regarded as political theater. Okay. It seems so quixotic that Trump should be held accountable in this retrospective way. It's in principle regarded here as something which, of course, is right and proper that someone who should have these charges against him should have those charges heard in a legalistic way and fully and forthrightly. But at the same time, I think people recognize that it's something of political theater, and the result is such a foregone conclusion that he will, of course, not be found guilty in this Senate trial. But it's still an important piece of political theater to go through, at least to air the issues about how far off America's rails of proper political conduct the previous administration found itself able to go.
You know, I was against a second impeachment, but the thing that I like what's come out of it is people have gotten to see unbiased and a video that was done by cameras that are just hanging there in the Capitol and by the cameras that were on the chest of the Capitol Police. And people got a chance to see exactly how violent it was, how out of control it was, and that they got a chance to see that the President of the United States sat for 3.5 hours and didn't do anything about it. And it might have supplied information to public officials in justice in Washington, D.C. and other places. And you know what? It became a bookmark in history. Now people have something that they can refer back to and see. And I think that's probably the only good thing that will come out of this trial is the fact that now, with everything that has been out and discussed and the images that people have never seen before, really does make this a bookmark in history that will be durable over the course of the next 100, 200 years.
As a journalist, I will have to say that everything that should be on the record is now clearly getting put on the record, and that's an important thing to do.
David, it's always great to talk to you. How much longer are you going to be over there?
Another couple of weeks at least.
Well, all right. Well, we'll speak to you next week and see as the world turns.
You'll hear from me.
All right, David. Take care.
Bye-bye.
David Terachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. And you can always find the Media Beat on demand, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on David Terachuk with the Media Beat.